Hi, this is Ron Barr. Thank you again for your contribution to the Sports Byline Interview Library GoFundMe campaign. It's deeply appreciated and will help preserve and grow this unique and wonderful collection. In appreciation for your contribution, here is our gift to you of the first Sports Byline commemorative interview collection. Every month we'll post new interviews, so check for the latest interviews. As a contributor, these interviews are available only to you. So feel free to tell your friends and family about our campaign so they'll have access to this collection as well. In this first edition, you'll hear Hall of Famers Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, Bill Russell, as well as Danica Patrick and Hall of Fame announcer John Miller. We hope you enjoy.
This is America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline USA. Here's Ron Barr.
I've told this story many times on the air, and I've told it many times as I speak around the country. When we launched Sports Byline USA back in 1988, my very first night, first hour, first guest on Sports Byline was Willie Mays. He was gracious enough to come visit here on the show in the studios. And from that particular point, we launched Sports Byline USA, and it's nice to have him back with us again. Willie, good evening to you. How are you?
Hi, Ron. Pretty good.
Good. Willie, when you stop to think about what baseball has meant to you and what you have meant to baseball, what thoughts do you have in both those areas?
Well, first of all, I think I love baseball very much. When I played 150 games for about 16, 17 years in a row. And what I try to do for the fans when I played is that I tried to create things as I went along. By that, I mean every day I try to do something different. And I never wanted to do the same thing, you know, day in and day out. You know, I feel that when the fans come to the ballpark and pay their money, they must see some kind of show, and that's what I try to do, you know, mainly.
How were you able to maintain that creativity for such a long time? Because after someone does something for a period of time, I would think it would get mundane.
Well, I don't think that was a problem, playing 150 games every year. You talking about playing games every year?
Right, and also being creative and being entertaining as you wanted to be.
Well, what about an actor when he plays in 8 or 9 movies? He's creative. He doesn't have the same role, mainly. I think I was in that same category, so it wasn't really hard to create things. It may not be in the outfield. I may not be at bat. It might be on the base. You never know. Or what you come up with. So what I try to do is just do something different somewhere in that area. If it was in the outfield, I would never catch fly ball the same way. I may catch it a basket catch, but something a little different.
Willie, you always had an enthusiasm for this game. What were the seeds of it? Take me back to the early beginnings of Willie Mays in baseball.
I can't take you that far back. I wish I could. I'd be playing now. I don't know. I never really look back on things like that because it's not really good for me to look back and try to figure out how did I get to this, this Hall of Fame type of thing. But, I love what I was doing. I love baseball, and I really appreciate baseball for getting me this far, because even though I played the game. But you have to keep your body in really, really good condition to play 150 games a year, and that's what I did. Not just for the baseball season, but off season. I did more work off season than I did on season. On season, I would sleep a lot, and I never had no problem about getting hurt or anything like that. So, I think it was good for baseball was good for both of us.
And of course, when you came in 1951 back in New York with the New York Giants, that was almost like a golden age of baseball back then. You had three teams. You had the Yankees, you had the Dodgers, and you had the Giants. What was it like to be in New York with those three teams at that time?
Well, my first year was kind of scary because I came to New York when I was about 19, just turned 20. And coming from Birmingham, Alabama was very scary because New York, I had read about it, and I had played there for a couple of years with the Birmingham Black Barons, so coming back to New York, being a player and being a star in the outfield in New York, it was kind of scary. But we had three good teams at that particular in that area. There's never going to be a city, I think, that had three good teams like that: the Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Giants. And like Mickey and I, we would laugh all the time. As long as they keep talking, let them talk. And we threw Duke in a little bit, and we always told him that, hey, you just ride our coattail, we'll be fine with you. So we just had fun back in the 50s, and it was no jealousy between the guys that played in New York. It was just pure fun.
Also, if you take a look at the polo grounds at Ebbets Field, they had distinctions. They were distinctively different. Can you talk about, first of all, the polo grounds where you played? What made it so unique?
Well, the Polo Ground started with 250 down each line and went out to around 477 in the corners. I mean, the left field gaps and the right field gap. Straightaway center field was 580. That was a fence out there where I made a catch in 1954, and that was about 458 right on the corner of the wall there. What made it so hard is that they didn't have padding on the wall out there. Everything was brick. And I really never had a problem myself because I'm playing center field, but it was a big center field. But, again, you don't play the center field. You play the hitters. You take a guy like Richie Ashburn, I would play him right behind second base because he was such a good hitter that he hit most of the line drives, so I would catch all of them. But you have to play the outfield rather than just playing, you know, in the ballpark.
Are you talking about the catch in the 54 World Series? Is that what you...
That was just one of them. I was just trying to give you a scenario about how you play in the Polo Ground, which was 580 compared to today, maybe 412, 420 or something like that.
What about Ebbets Field then?
Ebbets Field was about, center field was 397. Right field was 299. Left center was 347. Down the line was 340. It was like a little bandbox. We had fun over there. I myself hit close around 12 home runs there a year, and we only played about, I think, six or seven games there.
What has been the mystique about Willie Mays? Because the fans truly love you. I mean, when I was down at spring training with you this year and that young man came up to you and said, I didn't have a chance to watch you play in person, he said, but I just want to shake your hand. I think that says an awful lot about the love that baseball fans and fans in general have for Willie Mays. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a two-way street there. I have love for the fans when I play, and that's why I was trying to explain to you. I want to do something different for the fans each year, especially when they're young. And I think the guy that you're talking about might have been a young kid when I was playing. And I think he was trying to say to me, I want to give you something back, but the only thing I have right now is like I like to shake your hand, and that was enough for me. So I think it was a two-way street there, you know.
You told me a wonderful story one time about your rookie year when you were in New York and about, I guess you had a room in a rooming house that was next to a grocery store, and every time you played the Dodgers, you would come home. You remember that story?
10:30.
Yeah, and tell everybody what happened.
Yeah, I didn't know all this when I first went to New York. I didn't know so many, you know, guys would bet on games, and I would go home around 10 or 10:30, and there was a street full of guys there, and I was wondering what, I thought it was a fight or something, but they was waiting until I go in the house, and then they could go home, because they knew that if I went home, I wouldn't come out, so they had a good chance of winning the next day, so I didn't know all this until at the end of the season. Nobody would tell me, so finally, one of my friends told me, so, you know, we bet a lot of money on you this summer, you know. We made money, but nobody ever gave me anything, so I don't know what they would do, you know.
You hit not only for power with the 660 home runs, Willie, but you also hit for average, so you were a very smart hitter as well. Talk to me a little bit about the Willie Mays hitting philosophy.
I didn't have one. You see the ball, you hit it. My key to hitting, I think, was knowing the pitches. I don't think I was the best hitter. I was among the best hitters, but I wasn't the best hitter. Stan Musial, I think Joe was a good hitter. Ted Williams was to me the best hitter that I played against. But Hank was in the league too. It also had Eddie Matthews. We had a lot of good hitters when I played. So it wasn't just myself hitting. It was just a matter of trying to put the ball in play all the time and hustling down to first base. I didn't have a philosophy of trying to hit. And I think again, when you go up there trying to be too smart, I don't think you're gonna hit. I think you just go up there and you hit what you just see. If you see a slider going the other way, you carry it to right. If he pitches inside, you carry it to left. And if he pitches down the middle, you just hit it straight away. So it wasn't anything different that I did from anybody else. It's just that I just hit what I seen, you know.
You mentioned about Musial, you mentioned about Hank Aaron and others like that and yourself, but there were also great pitchers during that period of time. Talk to me a little bit about the pitchers that you faced, the ones you respected, the ones that really truly challenged Willie Mays.
Well, they all did that. We had guys that would go nine innings when I play, Koufax, Drysdale, Bob Gibson. You don't talk too much about Robert Roberts, Kirk Simmons. They had a kid in Chicago named Bob Rush. You had Juan Spahn, you had Lou Burdette. On every club that we played, you had three good pitchers that would go nine innings. We didn't have a lot of reliefers in the time I played. Maybe a couple of clubs would have a fairly good reliever, like Elroy Face was one of them. Chris Castagne was one with Philadelphia. Clem Levine was with the Dodgers. Joe Black was with the Dodgers. So it wasn't really a lot of them, you know, that came into relief, because they never was used that much, because all the guys that won 20 games, they went nine innings just about every day, you know.
Willie, hold on just a second. We'll only keep you a little bit longer. As we get ready to go to the break, let's share with you a great moment. Willie Mays, the catch in 1954 in the World Series.
There's a long drive way back in center field. Way back, back. It is home. And on second, Dolby is able to go to third. Willie Mays just brought this crowd to his feet with a catch, which must have been an optical illusion to a lot of people.
So one of the great and many great moments that Willie Mays provided all of us in baseball and in sports. We'll take a break, come back, and continue with more of you in America's Sports Talk Show. Bill Russell joins us on Sports Byline USA, the Hall of Fame Boston Celtics center. And, of course, he was declared the greatest player in the history of the NBA by the Professional Basketball Writers Association of America back in 1980. Five times the MVP of the NBA, played 13 seasons in the NBA, all of those with the Celtics, where he averaged 15 points, 4.3 assists, and 22.5 rebounds for his entire career. I've known Bill for many years because one of my stops in my career was up in Seattle, where Bill, of course, was the coach of the Seattle Supersonics. And as I was doing the games up there, I got to know Bill. But as much as I cherished what he was able to do in sports, what I enjoyed was the long conversations that we would have about life. And those are the things that stayed with me. And so with Bill in here tonight, it's something special. Bill, good evening to you.
Well, I'd like to say it's good to see you, Ron. But
here we go.
I'm not going to lie to you.
I knew I was in trouble. Oh, golly. I've told stories over the years of you coming over to me at the broadcast position during games and things you'd say to me. One particular moment was when you were playing in Boston with the Sonics, and you were so angry with your team in the second half because they weren't playing particularly well. And you came over and you said something to me, and I thought to myself, why is he telling me this? Why isn't he over there chewing out his team? So how are you doing? I mean, basketball has been such a big part of your life all your life. Was it hard to escape the fact that it was Bill Russell, basketball player, not Bill Russell, the person?
I never really considered that. My mother and father were so supportive. Like I always say, my first memory of life, the first thing I can remember, was that my mother and father loved me. And I carry that, you know, that's a heck of a start in life, is that, you know, when I was about three or four, the first time my mother let me go out and play out front, used to have to play in the back. She said, now you go out there and you play and have fun. People may come by, and they may say something to you. Don't pay any attention to it, because it has nothing to do with you. And because if people say something to you, whether they like you or dislike you, without knowing you, it has nothing to do with you. And so I pretty much live my life that way, in that I go and I do what I try to do and try not to bother anybody. And just live my life. And so it's mostly irrelevant what other people think.
Yeah, I mean,
that don't know me.
That's where the seeds came from for your self-esteem, I assume, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you grew up at a time where we didn't have a lot of tolerance in this country. Yes, you grew up in the Bay Area in California, which was certainly different. But and you were also not only a black man, but you were also growing into being a very tall black man. So you were conspicuous by size and by just looks.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed every inch and every minute of it.
Where did basketball come into your life?
Well, I'd never seen a basketball until I was nine. When my folks moved to Oakland, in Louisiana, I'd never seen a basketball. And then when I got to Oakland, we moved into the projects, and some of the kids that came up with a basketball backboard and rim and nailed it to a tree. And it was a cement square there, and they and so that was our basketball court. And so I started playing. And I always had fun, but I wasn't very good at it. But for me, it was playing. And playing is just playing, you know. There's no ulterior motive saying that I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. Just playing. And used to go out every day after school and in the summertime and just play.
Well, when did you begin to blossom and really appreciate and enjoy the game of basketball?
Well, I always enjoyed it. I didn't become a good player until I was out of high school. I was a...
You won three championships at McClyman's.
Right. But two of the championships, I didn't play a minute. My sophomore year, I was third string junior varsity. And I think I got into three or four games. And my junior year, I went out to junior varsity again, and I got cut the second day. But the varsity coach invited me to come and play on the varsity. And so I spent the season sitting on the bench. And my senior year, I played a half a year. I was a starter. And that was when I was starting to play. And then between February and September, I learned how to play. Things started to fall into place, and I could play then.
You went over to USF, and you say in your new book about the Jesuits taught you something. They taught you the difference between truth and lies, almost, in a sense. That experience over at USF, because you won two national championships there as well.
Yes. Well, first of all, I'll just say this. I think the Jesuits are the prime educators on the planet. Because their premise is, we trust our students with knowledge. And so they don't try to hide anything from you. And they feel if you're enlightened, you become a better person, and you have a better understanding of life and everything. So, but we were... the Jesuits at that time at USF didn't have a real they didn't place a real importance on athletics.
Now that's an understatement.
and so we were playing almost in a vacuum. It's like it's nice to have a good basketball team. It's okay, but we're not going to do anything to encourage or discourage it. And so my freshman year, I had a scholarship, and they said, if you make the varsity next year, your scholarship changes. Well, they decided not to change it, and I got a little upset. So I was going to leave. But the reason I was going to leave is that basically what had happened, we had made a contract. We had made a deal. If you do this, you know, get your grades and et cetera, and make the team, this is what you get. And then they decided to change that. Well, then I considered a broken contract. You know, it's so funny. I don't think they had any malice whatsoever. I don't think there was any ill feelings or anything. They just decided that for economic reasons, we're not going to do this. And I also cited for academic reasons that if that's the case, then I'll have to go elsewhere. But they changed it. So my sophomore year, I was on an academic scholarship. And I wasn't really academic.
You were always, and I've known you to be this way, you've always been a very highly principled man. You've got a Don Quixote-ish about you in that you stand up for things. I'll tell this story, and I don't know if you remember it or not, but you and I were in Boston, and we were having dinner in the team hotel, and I believe it was Mayor White, but don't hold me to that, but whoever was running for office and the mayor for the mayor's office in Boston, came into the restaurant where we were in the hotel, came over to you to say hello, and there were photographers with him, and started taking pictures. And you got upset. And the reason why you got upset was because, as you told me later, you said, I don't want to look like I'm endorsing this person who's running for office. I mean, you always had a sense about you, Bill, about what was right or wrong. And I'm just wondering what the seeds were of that. Where did that come from?
Well, basically, it's my grandfather and my father. My father was always my number one hero. And his father was his hero. And my grandfather used to say that every person has a line inside them that no one is allowed to cross. Then you invade their personage. And my father's the same way. So my attitude toward the society I live in is that I try my best never to bother anybody. You and I could come into this studio for the next 10 years, and unless you provoked me, I would never say anything unkind to you or rude to you. But conversely, I would never permit you to say anything unkind to me or rude to me.
Bill, how did you actually see basketball in your life beyond college? I don't think that you ever saw it as just a way out of the projects, but as just another part of your life. Am I correct in assuming that?
Well, one of the things I said in the book is that Havlicek and I were at the airport. I forget what city. And we were standing there talking, waiting. You know, we should spend a lot of time at airports, as you know. And this guy walked up to me and says, you a basketball player? And I said, no. And Havlicek, after he left, Havlicek said, why do you always say no? I've noticed that you always say no when people ask you a basketball player. I said, John, that's what I do. That's not what I am. That's my work. And I do that the very best I can, because my father, when I was young, told me that if you take a job, do it as best you can so that you can create integrity. He used to say, we're here in Louisiana, and he says, if you decide to be a ditch digger, which is a lowly profession, doesn't take much to do that. Here in Louisiana, you're digging ditches. I want people in Mississippi, Alabama, all the way to Florida, Texas, and Arkansas. I want them to say, there's this guy down in Monroe that's digging ditches. You've got to go see these ditches that he digs because they are a work of art. And he said, that's the way you should approach whatever you choose to do.
Bill Russell, Hall of Famer, has joined us and you here on Sports Byline. Danica Patrick joins us on Sports Byline. She has competed in the IndyCar Series, the NASCAR Nationwide Series, and the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series. And, of course, she is the most successful woman in the history of American open-wheel racing. She's the only woman to win the IndyCar Series and has the highest finish at the Indianapolis 500, which was third place back in 2009. You know, I was reading an article on you just today, Danica, and you the quote was, and it jumped right out at me, everyone learns at a different rate. And I don't really know what mine is. How difficult has it been for you to try to understand what that rate is and what you need to learn and how quickly it's coming?
Oh, I don't know if it's really something that you even need to learn. I think it's just something that is. You can't change it. You can't fix it. You can all you can do is continue to do your best, and that will help you learn as quickly as possible. But you know, it just takes time for stuff to sink in, and you have to have the experiences, too. You know, you have to experience things for yourself. So that it just takes time to accumulate those.
Which is harder, to learn the technique of driving on the NASCAR circuit or being able to control your emotions and your eagerness? Because you're a person that is very, very smart and very eager as well.
Oh, well, that's nice. I don't know if I'm very smart, but I think that temper can be one of the hardest ones just because it's so impulsive. And so there's no sensor for that because it's just something that happens as a reflex. So I think that's something that it's taken a long time for me to learn how to keep under control.
I think you know as well as I do that respect in sports is something that is earned, and I would think it's hard for anybody, but particularly if it happens to be a woman who's in a predominantly male-driven sport. And I'm wondering, has that been difficult for you? Have you had to deal with some things that maybe other male drivers would not have to deal with?
Well, the good news is I don't know any different. So so it's not like I wish it was a different way. I don't know. I've always been in this position, and you know, I'd like to think that it just takes time to earn everyone's respect around you, and that you know, maybe it more boils down to the confidence level of the people you're dealing with. I find that the more confident people are, the less they care about, you know, a girl running well or beating them ever. So you know, you just have to earn that respect.
I'm going to use a baseball analogy here because I have a lot of my friends that are Major League Baseball players, and pitchers will tell me, Danica, that when they go over, say, or they're first in the league, the American League or the National League, they have to learn the parks, they have to learn the batters and everything. Is it the same way for you learning the tracks?
Yeah, absolutely. Learning tracks, learning the car. The car is the most important thing, and just learning how to get it to its limit and what it feels like when you know, you've reached that. So, yeah, that just takes time, absolutely. And just learning the kind of ebb and flow of the race and the weekend itself, and when to get excited about things and when to not worry about it.
You know, when I talked to Tony Stewart one time, I asked him, I said, how quickly can you tell what kind of car do you have underneath you when you're getting ready to race? And he answered the question for me. What process do you go through mentally to be able to understand what kind of car you're driving in any race?
You're asking me what process do I go through?
Right.
Oh, that's the process I'm in right now. I think one of the things that's really unique about NASCAR compared to IndyCar, at least, is that in IndyCar, the car stayed quite consistent throughout the weekend. Once you achieved a balance, for the most part, you know, it was very similar from there on out. In NASCAR, you can hop into the car from one day to the next, and you don't know what happened. It feels different. And you go into the race, and all of a sudden you're like, holy crap, why does the car feel like this? And the car changes throughout the race and the run, and, you know, you just got to keep up with that. So I don't, you know, like, I wouldn't know exactly from the first lap out whether or not the car would be fast for the whole race weekend or not. I could tell you whether or not it'd be fast the next lap. I can tell you when a lap is good and when it's not. And I can tell you that, you know, maybe I'll have some kind of indication as to whether or not the car will be good in the race. But, you know, it's, I feel like in NASCAR, it's something I'm still learning.
I'm assuming then, off of what you just said, communication is one of the key things for you or any driver, being able to communicate with their crew chief so they can help you better understand your car.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there's every driver describes the feeling of the car, and there's no like playbook on when you say the car is a 2 out of 5 tight. That's not the same for everyone. In fact, that's not the same for anyone. So it's the crew chief's and the driver's job to get used to each other enough to know, like, what does that really mean? How big of a change do I need to make, and what kind of a change is needed?
You've had a couple of crew chief changes lately, and I'm just wondering, how long does it take for the chemistry between crew chief and driver, like yourself, to be able to blend together?
No time at all. If the chemistry's there, it's there. If it's not, it's not.
What do you look for as far as chemistry to know that it's there then, Danica?
I don't think you can. I don't think I know exactly what that is. I don't think anyone knows what produces chemistry between people. I think that it's just an experience that you have to have, and that's why sometimes, you know, you go through, you know, that's why you work with someone and maybe find out it doesn't work after a while because, you know, it just doesn't come around and something's not clicking quite right. But I can definitely tell you that the chemistry with Tony Gibson was there right from the get-go, and of course, because that's the way it goes. You either get along with somebody and you feel like you understand each other and respect each other and enjoy being around each other, or you don't.
Yeah, because you said, I've learned it just takes time, and having the right people around you is important. Certain things sink in quickly and easily, and other things take a little bit longer. Is communication the key to that that blend as quickly as possible?
Yes. Communication, and I think trust.
And how do you define trust?
Like when I say what the car is doing, you don't second guess it, and you just make a change. And yeah, you know, I trust that whatever he's doing is the right thing, and I believe in his ability purely, and I don't question that. I think that's the kind of trust that you need.
You know, you started go-kart racing when you were 10 years old. At 16, you moved to England to race in the British National Series. Take me back and help me to understand what it was about racing that attracted you, Danica.
It wasn't speed. That's not my thing. In fact, I don't like going fast even. I don't know. I get scared. I was on a boat this summer, and we were out on a lake, and the boat was a speed boat, and I think we got up to like 116 or 19 miles an hour. And I was definitely the first one to tap out and say, why don't you just back it on down for me, please? So when I first got into racing, I mean, I loved seeing the improvement. I loved that lap time coming down, you know, that instant gratification. So I just like setting a goal and achieving it.
You know, you may be the only one I know that is in a sport in which they go a couple hundred miles an hour, but when you drive your personal car, you're not looking to go that fast. Because Jimmy Johnson, I asked him, I said, how hard was it for you once you come off the track not to put your foot down on the pedal when you're driving out on the highways? And he started laughing. He says, you know, Ron, he says, sometimes that is difficult, but it's probably not for you, is it, Danica?
No, sometimes it can be. Sometimes you just feel racy. I don't know if it's necessarily about needing to put your foot down. You just feel impatient because you spent your entire day not being patient with people. You try and get by them as quickly as possible. So I think that's more of what it is for me.
We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to ask you about the marketing of Danica Patrick. Peyton Manning is a friend of mine, and I talked to him a little bit about, you know, how he approached the business side of football. How have you approached the things outside of auto racing and how you want to be represented?
I think that's something that develops over time, and I think that you end up finding things that make sense for you, things that are true, things that fit. You know, for instance, today I'm in L.A. It's World COPD Day, and COPD is a disease that my grandma had and killed her, and you know, I'm just trying to raise awareness for that. And I think that these are the things that you find along the way that just make sense. And, you know, you got to follow your heart.
Given the demands that go along with your sport and your profession, is it hard to balance the two?
I think early on it is. When you don't have as many opportunities, it does get a little bit tough because, you know, you're kind of in a position to say yes to anything. So I'm very fortunate to be in the position I'm in.
You know, I don't see you saying yes to anything. I mean, you pick the choose the things that you want to do.
I've been called like, you know, Mrs. No or something like that, because I say no to everything, and then you have to tell me why I should. But luckily, I have plenty of people in place and good people that get to figure all that stuff out for me, and I would say that I don't really have to say yes and no to all that many things anymore. It's usually doesn't come to my desk until, let's face it, I don't have a desk, but it doesn't come to my desk figuratively unless it's something I probably should do.
We only have 20 seconds left. I'm sure you'd like to send a shout out to the troops that get a chance to hear us worldwide and also in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your tireless efforts for our country, and thank you for your commitment and your courage. I just hope that hopefully you're entertained a little bit by this conversation and it sent you to a good place where you could laugh and smile a little bit before you get on with your work.
I want to thank you for your time as well. Danica, take care. Come back anytime on Sports Byline.
All right. Thank you.
Danica Patrick with us. We continue with America's Sports Talk Show. And now here is our interview with the late and great Hall of Famer, Mickey Mantle. Nice to have Mickey Mantle with us. 18 seasons with the Yankees, and he played in those 12 World Series and has co-authored the book All My Octobers, My Memories of 12 World Series When the Yankees Ruled Baseball. And Mickey, good evening. Nice to have you with us here on Sports Byline.
Thank you, Ron.
You know, I was reflecting this afternoon, Mickey, on the fact that back in the 50s, when you take a look at New York and New York baseball, you had the Giants, you had the Dodgers, and you had the Yankees. And I've talked to a lot of people that referred to that as kind of the golden age of baseball. That was a special time in that city for baseball, wasn't it?
Well, it's when I went up in 1950. Well, Willie came up in 51, too. So we both came up, and Duke was already there. And to me, it was the golden age. I'm not saying that it really was. I mean, I don't have the right to say that. But to me, it was my golden age, yeah.
When you take a look at the Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Giants, the fans were either Yankee fans, Dodger fans, or Giants fans. They didn't cross over, did they?
You mean up there in New York?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. If you lived in Brooklyn, you was a Dodger. If you lived in the Bronx, you was a Yankee, and then the Giants.
Mays told me a story one time, Mickey. He said when he came up with the Giants, he said he had this little room just astride of a grocery store, and he said the day before they used to always play the Dodgers, he would come home, and there'd be a lot of people around the grocery store, and he said he'd go upstairs and then kind of peer out the window because he didn't understand it, and he said when he'd look out the window, they were gone. So he came back into the clubhouse, and being a rookie player, a young player, he'd ask some of the players what that was all about, and they just started laughing. He says, can't you figure that out? He says, that's all the Dodger fans or the Giants fans who want to know what time you got in so they knew how to bet on the game the next day.
Well, they would have had to stand around the St. Moritz Hotel to catch me.
Tell me a little bit, if you will, about the book, because you do lament in some ways some of the losses, and you also share some of the victories of the 12 World Series that you played in. Was this a joy to write this book about the World Series?
Mickey Herskowitz, who wrote it, knew a little bit more about it than I did. Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed going back, remembering things, I think 1952. Well, in 51, we played the Giants. That's how I hurt my knee. That was gave me trouble all my life. Willie Mays hit a pop fly to right center, and I was playing right field. And Casey had told me before the game that Joe D was having trouble with his heels, so try to take everything I could get. And I was running as fast as I could over to right center. And when I got there, he was already standing under it. He had a real knack of being able to know where the ball was going to be, I guess. Anyway, when I tried to stop, I hurt my leg. That was the 51 World Series. Then the next year, we played the Dodgers, and we beat the Dodgers. And I can remember that after the last game, Jackie Robinson came in our clubhouse. This was after we had won the series. And he was going around congratulating everybody, telling them nice series. And he came over and patted me on the back, and he said, "Kid, you're going to be a hell of a player someday." I never will forget that one.
You said losing the 1960 World Series to the Pirates with Mazeroski's dramatic home run was the worst. Why did it hurt more than the other four series you lost?
I felt like that we had a lot better team than the Pirates did that year, and Casey didn't start Whitey. I mean, Whitey's got the best pitching records in the World Series of anybody, and why he didn't start him, he never did say why. And we could never figure that out. I think Whitey shut him out twice in that series, but he could have won three games, I think, if he would have started. And we never did find out why. But anyway, we scored almost, I think, twice as many runs as they did or something. And Mazeroski, of course, hit that last home run, beat us. And I just felt like that we had a better team than they did. When was it, 1962, when the Dodgers beat us four in a row?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had Drysdale and Koufax and Padres. I mean, they had a great pitching staff, and that's what you got to look at. You remember what Yogi said, 90% of baseball is pitching, and the other 30% is mental.
Mickey, also, I don't know that there was a greater collection of players collectively for a longer period of time than the Yankees with all the successes that they had in baseball. But one of the things that I remember as a kid listening to the Yankees over those successful years was the fact that they had a great bench, and I don't know that they ever got the credit for the bench. They had a lot of players on the bench that could have been starters for a lot of other teams.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the reason, they talk about me playing with bad legs a lot. Hell, I was afraid to get out of the lineup because we had, Jackie Jensen, Bob Serve, Irv Norn. The guys on our bench were as good as the guys playing, I thought, and you just didn't want to get out of the lineup. You just try to stay in there and keep hitting or doing whatever you was doing to help the team, because if you got out, you might not get back in. And I've always said that, too. You're about the first one I've heard really mention that, but we did, and we always had, they used to call us the Bronx Bombers,
mm-hmm.
And I can remember a lot of games when we played like the Cleveland had a great pitching staff, and Allie Reynolds and Vic Rashie and Whitey Ford would go out and beat them 3-2 or 2-1, 1-0. I mean, we wasn't the Bronx Bombers when we played real good pitching, but we had great pitching in those days, too, and real good defense also.
I remember talking and spending some time with your friend, the late Billy Martin, and we used to talk about the Yankees down in his office. And I asked him about the mystique of wearing a Yankee uniform, and when he talked about it, I could just see in his eyes, Mickey, the love that he had for it. Is today, are you still able to have, if you wear a Yankee uniform, that feeling, or has it been kind of watered down because of the movement of players and just the dynamics that we see in baseball today?
Well, seem wrong. I haven't played for 25 years.
Well,
so
I know
that.
But the feeling's like there now.
But I've always felt like that family. People ask me a lot, what made the Yankees the Yankees? And I always felt like it was a family-type feeling that we had toward each other. Like when I went up in 51, I was only 19 years old. And Hank Bauer took me in, you know. He was like my big brother, along with Yogi and Allie Reynolds, Vic, and all those guys, you know. Me and Billy and Whitey were like little kids compared to the rest of them. And Casey didn't even have to ball. If we did something that was wrong, I mean, Casey didn't even have to get on us. One of them other guys, one of the big brothers on the team, would grab us and shake us a little bit and say, "Hey, you better straighten up, man. You're messing with our money."
You arrived in New York at the age of 19, as you said, and you struggled at the very beginning. You were sent down to Kansas City, and then you had a chat with your dad. What was it that he said to you?
Well, it wasn't very nice. I called him. I got to striking out a lot, and I lost my confidence. And Casey called me in the office in Detroit. We was on the road, and he had tears in his eyes, and he told me, he said, "Mickey, I'm going to send you back down to the minors. You've lost all your confidence. All you got to do is go down there and start hitting the ball again, and just as soon as you do, we're going to bring you back. But that's the only way you can get your confidence back." So when he sent me down the first time up in Kansas City, I used to be able to drag the ball and get on about any time I wanted to. And I drug a bunt and got on, and the Kansas City manager was George Selkirk. And he called me over after that, and he said, "Hey, Mick, they didn't send you down here. We know you can bunt. They sent you down here to start hitting the ball with power again so you'll get your confidence back and you can go back up there." Well, I went 0 for 22 after that first bunt. And I went in, when we got back to Kansas City, I called my dad. We only lived in Oklahoma, about 150 miles from Kansas City. I called my dad and said, "Dad, this is Mick. I don't feel like I can play baseball." He said, "Where you at?" And I said, "In the hotel in Kansas City." He said, "Wait right there. I'll be right there." And he came up there, and when it took him about 2 hours to get up there. And he knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and he just kind of shoved me out of the way, and he pulled my suitcase out and started throwing my clothes. I said, "What are you doing, Dad?" And he said, "Hell, I'm taking you home." He said, "You can go back and work in the mines with me." He said, "I thought I raised a man. You're nothing but a coward." And, I mean, he had tears in his eyes, and he really let me have it. I thought he was going to come up and pat me on the shoulder and said, "Hang in there, kid. You're going to be all right." But that was the farthest thing from what he said.
In the epilogue of the book, you do talk about your dad a great deal, and you really quite candidly talk about the effect that your dad had and how it might have affected you as far as your drinking. You say, "The turning point for me was when my dad died of Hodgkin's disease during my second season with the Yankees. He was barely 41. If he had lived longer, I don't think the problem was gone as far as it did." And then you write something that I think is very prophetic. You say, "I couldn't have faced my dad if he knew I was drinking."
My real bad drinking didn't really start until after I was, but I did have to retire early. I had that bad leg. I didn't even go and do my, exercises and stuff to get my muscles back. I was just kind of in a fog or something, you know, and it did hurt my game. I know that when my dad died, because he was part of the thing. You know, he used to say the only thing he lived for was baseball and for me to play. He named me after a baseball player. Mickey Cochran.
We continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline. One of the things that makes sports special is our ability to hear or see on TV a great moment. Usually the broadcasters, the voices of the game, emblazon that moment in our minds and hearts forever. ESPN baseball announcer John Miller is one of the best of those voices. He's multi-talented and was influenced as a kid by one of broadcasting's all-time greats, Vin Scully.
I love Vin Scully. I think he's the best who's ever broadcast baseball. People love Harry Carey, might not feel that way about Vinny, but for me, he's the best ever. I never understood his international fame until I went to Japan last year with the Major League All-Star team, televised a couple of games, and I had a chance at long last to hear the legendary Genshiro Asami, the great broadcaster of the Tokyo Giants, lo these many years. And I was very excited. I filled with expectation. Flipped on the TV, and you can imagine my surprise when he came on, and he was doing Scully. You know, "Watashi wa Karakuen Stadium ni orimas. Hajime Majde Dozi Yorushka Lo Ball Two. You know, Odote Ta Dakemasenka Foul. You know.
Thank you again, and we hope you enjoyed it. I'm Ron Barr.